The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
So people file in, I'm sure they can catch on. My name is Umbreen Ali. I'm the vice chair of the Salt Board and also a freelance reporter based here in D.C. And I'm really excited about this panel. This is the second time we're having a media session as part of the summit. And certainly since the last time we had this discussion in 2007, I think the media landscape has changed a lot. There are so many outlets through which you can get your message out to the people. But judging from the amount of complaints I get about how the media gets stories wrong, how the media kind of perpetuates like these false fear-mongering, I think that it's true that the media still carries a lot of weight in how we perceive public opinion. So we're very blessed today to have a panel that reflects both mainstream journalists and also a communications person who, like maybe some of you, is a spokesperson for a nonprofit. So before I introduce them, I just want to note that in addition to the papers that you guys have in front of you that provide some like tips on messaging, there are several how-tos and CDs that you received this morning. As part of your like conference type, there's information on preparing press releases, making a publicity plan, and communicating with journalists that I think are really useful. So please, after you go home on Monday, take a look at the CD and see what's inside. So I think the format for this, we have about an hour, is going to be, at first I have a few sort of start-off questions for these guys here, and then it's going to be Q&A. But after I introduce them, I just want to get a few people's thoughts on what you want to hear, because there's so much that we could cover, and I want to make sure that our conversation is headed in the right direction. So right next to me is Kavita Cardoza, who, if you are a local, you know, is kind of a celebrity. You've heard her on WAMU, the 88.5, and we're really blessed to have her here. She actually just came to the area last year from Illinois, where she was the bureau chief of WUIS / WIPAFM. Which doesn't make sense to me, but I'm sure it does to the people there. It's in Springfield. So she is a reporter, right, a news reporter at WAMU. And then next to her is Arun Venkopal, who's coming here from WNYC. He was also on the panel 2 years ago, if any of you were here. He's a reporter as well, and that's an NPR affiliate, just like WAMU. He covers all sorts of issues from local politics and civil rights, and he used to work in ethnic media, which we'll also talk about. He worked with India Abroad and Rediff. And then the last person on our panel is Muhammad Alam, who is with SUTKI for South Asian Women, and he joined them last year in March. His role is to spearhead SUTKI's efforts to educate, raise awareness, and create dialogue to help end domestic violence. And he's responsible for the media advocacy, the production of SUTKI's media, community engagement, and strategic relationship building. So, like I said, it's sort of a diverse group of people who can provide us some good perspective on how to pitch our stories as part of the nonprofit sector, and also hear from them what it is that they want from us. Like, you know, just to make sure that we're giving them the right information, that we're guiding them to the right events. So that's sort of the frame that I was thinking of and that we had discussed previously, but if I could just get like two or three people to share what they want to get out of this session, I think that would help us guide our questions a little bit. Any volunteers? Yes.
When we go to press, or the local press, or the South Asian press, we know what our agenda is, what we want to get out. I'd like to know what the press's agenda is, so we can give them the stories that we really want to print.
Great. And I along similar lines, what you're saying.
Okay. And anybody else? Okay, well, I think that's a very helpful sort of frame for this discussion. And so, you know, judging from that question, let's just start with the reporter side of the coin. I'll ask both Kavita and Arun, what makes a story, and what draws your attention and interest to a story?
Certainly something that's new, something that ask yourself the question, why should people care? And with a mainstream outlet, why should people who aren't South Asian care? Why should people who aren't in that person's family, you know, whatever that's, you know, is happening, why should they care? I always ask myself, well, why should people care? Why should I care? It's always good to have a person. A lot of times I get press releases with a lot of statistics, which are very interesting, and then there's no person to sort of back it up. Radio is a very intimate medium. You hear people's voices. I always want to have someone who's affected by whatever it is. Something that's unusual, something that's timely. A lot of times we get press releases. I guess this is what not to do, but we get press releases the morning of. A lot of times we set, I decide what I'm going to be doing well in advance. So if it comes the morning of, it might be a great story. You know, I'm not going to be able to do it.
I think following up on what you're saying, something that is different. It's obviously very subjective, and that also depends on who you want to appeal to. If you're thinking about whether it's the ethnic media or the mainstream media, and even within the ethnic media or what have you have different segmentation. You have your India abroad, India West, and then you have the blogs, which are obviously much more important than they were before. When you have youth culture, that kind of thing, which is very interested, they have very strong community components in terms of discussion, very active that way. And even in the mainstream media, you know, it depends on, it's a moving target in a sense, because mainstream media, in terms of how it approaches an issue in an immigrant community or what have you, it's different now than it was 3 or 4 years ago. There's a different awareness of certain issues. There are different sort of touchstones now. Some of that is driven by, you know, big splashy media kinds of things or whatever. Other are driven by, you know, catastrophes within an immigrant community. Somebody dies, it's domestic abuse, what have you kind of thing. So it takes some savvy, you know, some awareness of, you know, who do you really want to deal with? Do you need the broader public to know about it, or do you need to know, need people within your own ethnic enclave to know about it? So an India abroad reporter is obviously going to be a little more jaded to certain kinds of stories than the reporter at your local daily or radio station. So that takes some sort of strategy in terms of, you know, when you're thinking in terms of the next 2 years, who do I need to get the word out to? You got to kind of figure out those kinds of things in terms of, and some of these issues obviously play to both audiences. Besides the statistics, if you can back that up with human interest, having access to those voices, if you can say, we're going to get you not only the access to that person who is a victim or whatever, but also the translator who's going to be there if they only speak Urdu and the reporter doesn't probably, that's been a problem for me, you know. Even for the mainstream, they don't actually know a lot of these resources exist. They don't necessarily know that there is, say, a listserv that deals with your South Asian psychologists, therapists, counselors, that kind of a thing. Once they know about that, then they're like, wow, suddenly the opportunities explode, what they can do. Even a lot of ethnic media don't know that, but yeah.
I wanted sort of to reframe the question for you. How do you think about, how do you determine what stories will be interesting to the media? How do you decide what the media persons that you're interacting with are interested in?
Mm-hmm. A little bit of background as a reporter, for suburban dailies in Massachusetts and a couple of the weeklies in Queens, so I did have a little bit of sense of, what media are generally interested in. And I mean, number one is drama a lot of the time, something, a dramatic event, which in the anti-domestic violence context is also usually a tragic event. So a murder or murder-suicide in the South Asian community, that it becomes something that attracts attention. And, you know, it's difficult to deal with that sometimes because we're not an organization that works, based on individual incidents. You know, we have a philosophy and a sustained programming over 20 years now for survivors. So you have to be prepared to respond to requests for one thing. But in terms of generating as much media interest as we can, there's also not just the drama, but the data. The data sometimes can be quite interesting. For instance, in 2008, as part of our policy advocacy, we're doing the Court Interpreters Project. Basically, we're trying to ensure that interpretation in the court system in New York is improved, because in the past there had been issues where interpreters were not trained the right language, or were telling survivors in their language that they shouldn't be here and what are they doing, and you know, these kinds of reactionary attitudes. So in connection with that, we actually did a survey of court interpreters across the country. So we surveyed 157 court interpreters, and you know, we got some interesting responses, like what they themselves saw as the key aspects of the court system. You know, so of course, any survey turns out some interesting talking points and key findings of data. So, you know, we thought that was media worthy. And of course, I think in addition then to the drama and the data is the human interest aspect. Again, a domestic violence perspective, usually the story of a survivor is of interest, and you know, usually when media outlets reach out to us, they do want to speak to a survivor, and perhaps I can go into detail later, but this raises confidentiality issues, because we can't necessarily showcase, you know, if you will, a survivor's plight if that's going to put her in danger. So.
Okay, so let's flip the question. What are examples of stories that you're not interested in?
No hard feelings.
I think for me it's award ceremonies. I don't know why. I just every time I get a press release and it's like so-and-so is getting an award, I'm like, oh, you know, because I think a lot of organizations, and I've you know what it's like to really work hard and you know get all these applications in and have the whole ceremony, but that is not important. The people who are getting the awards are important, and if I was doing a story, I would want to know you know, beforehand, so profile them, not in context. The award is sort of, you know, by the way. Just to back up a bit, when I talk at forums like this, oftentimes I people who are not reporters or not in the mainstream media, always sort of there's this impression I get that they feel that they're not in a position of strength. And you are. It's not like the media is one big, you know, sort of institution, and exactly. And you're like, oh, please tell my story, please tell my story. Think about statistics. I mean, how many South Asians do you have in your community? Well, the media has a sort of a mission, at least public radio does, to cover underserved communities, to cover minority communities. So if you can say, hey, you know, we really haven't had a story on, and we're, you know, 15% of the population, and we'd really love you to do a story on that. Awesome. You know, for sure, that'll make start reporters thinking, hey, yeah, that's true, because they want to cover underserved communities. It would be really great to get pitched stories where Asians were not, you know, I wasn't sort of talking to Asians who were doctors, computers, you know, or engineers, because that to me is so much the stereotype that that's all Asians do. I mean, I'd love to talk to Asians in different professions. So I think you should think a little bit more about the position of strength, what you bring to the table. Often, like when there were the Mumbai, you know, attacks, or when there was, you know, when there's something like horrific, like a domestic violence, this thing. I often hear, you know, non-South Asians commenting. And while sometimes that's interesting, I'm like, you know, why weren't, you know, you guys who are, you know, working in these fields saying, hey, you know, this is us, we can talk about this, we can, you know, I don't get press releases where it's like, hey, I'm an expert, I can talk, put me, you know, down if you ever need someone on such and such topic. And I feel that a lot of other groups are very, very savvy at doing that through the year.
Yeah, I think that is changing, but I mean, and that changes when you have a group like Saki, which has the resources to have somebody who is really focusing on media, that kind of thing. Otherwise, when you have two people, one of whom is full time or one of whom is, you know, part time, it's obviously very difficult to be focusing on writing those op eds, that kind of stuff. So it's unfortunately just the reality that when you have a community which is, you know, only in the last so many years is really kind of arriving in terms of its nonprofits or what have you, you have those groups within them who actually are connections within the media, to the media, who can say, really spend time with them, who have the sophistication to tell them a story, who know how to basically get their attention without really browbeating them, that kind of thing. That's really, sort of chiming in on what she said, things like we are occasionally pitched on stuff like, yeah, that award ceremony. Can you come on Saturday afternoon? And you're like, I actually have something else to do on Saturday afternoon. I have no way I'm going to get that story out. There's nobody who's going to be interested. There's also a certain kind of unrelentingly negative kind of, sad story, which you just don't know how to tease it out in a way which has life to it, And that is obviously a very tough thing, because there are people within my newsroom who do that stuff all the time, because that is just their beat, And, obviously people who cover poverty and stuff like that. But there is a certain kind, and it's such a subjective thing, but knowing how to pitch a story which has obviously the reality, which is often kind of brutal, but at the same time has some level of nuance in it, which may in some sense concede that some, the administration has done these things right, but right now this is really wrong, and this is how you're seeing happen. Homeless shelter, numbers are going up, and that was actually improving before. So I sense that the person who's bringing the story to me is actually not, kind of just negative in every sense of the word about whether it's the mayor or, the Department of Aging or what have you, that I can trust them to give me both the reality this is bad, we have these 5-10 victims who, this is a problem, but at the same time, there are ways this can be made better, and we've seen that in the past, that kind of stuff. So not basically just making it seem like too pathetic, I guess, So... it's a trick, it's not easy.
Mohammed, do you have any specific sort of pitches that you've done that you can think of that resonates with what Arvind and Felipa are saying?
It's interesting, actually, the question of, organizations that are very quick and savvy to jump on points. You'd mentioned non-South Asian organizations are often, quicker to watch. And I think, part of that is maybe a size thing. I mean, South Asian organizations are often small. Our organization is, 8 staff members. One example, I think, was in February this year, a Muslim woman was killed in Orchard Park. She was allegedly actually beheaded by her husband in a television station office. And in that particular case, there was a history of domestic violence. The victim had taken order of protection, was going through divorce proceedings, and police confirmed that there was a history of abuse. But, so the media there, I believe it was the Buffalo News, they went to NOW, National Organization of Women, in New York State. And, the New York State president of NOW issued a statement that we and a number of other South Asian groups thought was problematic. She described it as, I believe, a terroristic version of honor killing. And, honor killing is this kind of exoticized term, becomes a code word. Is, I think, an attempt just to distinguish what happens. Domestic violence there doesn't happen here, doesn't happen to whites, doesn't happen to Americans, etc. Ourselves and other South Asian groups that work with domestic violence survivors, had drafted a letter, but we didn't actually want it to give it too much publicity because, we figure we all work in this movement together, and we didn't want to perhaps a phrase, air the dirty laundry so much. We wanted to work with NOW, but express our criticism within that context. So we draft that letter and we send it off to them, but we didn't, raise any hackles in the media. So it's interesting. Sometimes politics is also a factor too, internal politics.
That raises a really interesting point that sometimes you don't want to involve the media, and I think maybe we can talk about a little bit when you do get a reporter interested in a story, sometimes there's a disconnect between what the person who's pitched it wants to be published and what gets published. So can you guys talk a little bit about what happens when you agree to take on a story and what people can expect in terms of, as a reporter, what you're going to do in print?
I think you know, sometimes you don't know. You just go in and you sort of fish around and then you figure out what the story is. Very often I don't go in and say, okay, I mean, I know, like, recently I covered something on the Anacostia cleanup. Well, what is the angle? That problem has been going on for ages. So go in, keep asking questions, and then I'm like, it may or may not be what the person who picked the story wants. When you involve the media, I think you have to be really open. So, for example, often when I ask money questions, people are like, no, don't put that in the story. I'm like, no, I have to, you know. I mean, people want to know how much your organization is making or whatever. Okay, so there are, I think, to me, you sort of have to be prepared for anything. Yeah. Because I don't know what the story is.
Yeah, I don't know if I have a very good answer for that. It's true, you have to basically just sort of, there is obviously some sort of a leap of faith you have to take with the reporter. And I think that to some extent, if you have the strength to give them that nuance that might say, actually, okay, well, obviously some of this is not as negative, or, you know, as we said or whatever, but in the knowledge that they might run something which is actually contradicting the overall thrust of the story you'd like to run. But then, you know, then they do trust you more, you know, and they feel like if you say something like that, then you know what you're talking about and you're not trying to sell them trying to, you know, get one past them or whatever. It's a tough thing. Sometimes your people you're advocating for will say something that kind of contradicts the story or whatever. And whether the reporter actually uses that amongst the other hour and a half of interviews that they, you know, they've done or whatever, there's so much subjectivity, you know. Sometimes the thing that leaps off the page is unfortunately the thing that might actually not be the basic story, you know. So that subjectivity is there.
Okay, Arun, I know you have some experience in ethnic media. Maybe we can talk a little bit about the value of getting something placed in ethnic media versus mainstream media and, you know, how an organization should make the decision to target one or the other. Sometimes organizations think of ethnic media as like the first step, and then after that you get to mainstream media, but is that really the case?
I mean, the thing is that, you know, obviously with ethnic media, there is that level of intimacy that your audience has with the subject that somebody does not when they're reading a mainstream paper. And that explanation and stuff like that, or the nuances of the culture that you kind of feel like the mainstream reporter is not going to get, that can be frustrating. Then again, many ethnic press outlets are not as smoothly run, you know, and you see that like complete butchery of something you said, that typo, or just you're like, nobody said that, we didn't even say that, who's that person, you know, that kind of stuff. It's so embarrassing, you know, and you're like, do I need to even, you know, is there any point in writing a letter to them, you know, will they even acknowledge it, you know, I mean, this is all familiar terrain, obviously, you know, and, It's a tough call, you know, who you deal with. You know, I do think that, like I said earlier, you know, when you have your CPU mutinies or you have your, you know, other blogs, it's interesting because then you have certain things that happen, online discussions sometimes, which obviously can have a life of their own, for better or worse. But those are things that were not there 5 years ago, you know. And they also inform, say, both the ethnic press, and they often inform the mainstream sometimes, because now the blogosphere has such a strong, you know, role to play. I don't think you should think of it necessarily as a stepping stone, because sometimes it's like, you know, it's different strategies. You know, this is something that we really need people in our community to know. One thing that Purvi said a couple years ago here was like, you know, there is always that nice thing with India Abroad. You can just write them the piece, and then they might run into community as a correspondent, you know? So then you're like, it's basically a press release without the press release caption. And then occasionally you'll have that person in the ethnic press who's just, like, really into, you know, the broader story. They're going to write, like, a 3,000-word piece, you know? That's what I used to do. I used to do long pieces in India Abroad, and it was really very satisfying, actually, because I could spend a lot of time doing that kind of stuff. And, you know, the nuances, that kind of stuff. And with the mainstream, it's just a different beast. I mean, now what I don't write much that much freelance as I like, but I do. And I run this blog for Saja, and sometimes the stories lead to other press coverage, you know, because a lot of reporters and editors, that's our main audience. Not main, but it's a good chunk of it, you know. It's people who are in the press in North America and probably in Pakistan, India, a few other places. And so it translates. It might be a simple kind of a thing, you know, a blog post. And then that, I mean, it happened, I guess, a couple weeks ago, I'm told that we wrote about this thing called the South Asian Philanthropy Project. I think they're here at this conference. And, you know, it took me a few weeks to finally get around to doing it, but then I think that converted into an India West article. And that's satisfying, because then you feel like even though you're a small blog, then it has a life, you know, beyond that. But yeah, I think you ought to be networking with both people and both sides, and think of it in terms of long term. And especially with mainstream, they might need some time. You know, put them on your listservs or whatever, your email lists, and then, you know, cultivate that slow sort of appreciation that they recognize you as somebody, even if it's just like they might delete, you know, every other email that you send them or more. But then eventually, when you go to them and say, "Hey, listen, I just want to get your attention this time. This is really interesting." And then suddenly you're not a stranger to them. You're somebody who's like, they look back at the history of your emails and they're like, "Oh yeah, this person seems to know what they're talking about. They've got the access and stuff like that. There are ways for me to cover this besides relying on them solely," that kind of stuff, you know, but they're a voice. So suddenly a year and a half into this relationship you had, a very passive relationship, suddenly you kind of like, basically you play your card and hopefully it works, and maybe not, but then again you try more forcefully, you know, later. But hopefully you don't burn your bridge by trying too hard, you know.
Yeah, I think it's all about trust and about making those connections. Call rather than, I mean, you can send an email, but I always, you know, when you call and you hear someone's voice, you know, it's really hard to say no sometimes. So you're like, "Oh, okay, I'll look at your, you know, your..." Even if you can't cover it, very often I do long pieces, so I don't have a lot of time to do the shorter stories. I, you know, if it's someone I've spoken to, you know, and it's hard to say no to a DC, I say, you know, I could say, at least at my old station, I could go to my news director and say, "Hey, can someone else cover this? This is pretty, you know..." Because there are meetings, right? So if I can't do it, someone else will. You know, I think that's really important to form those relationships.
Kavita, I know you have some experience in media in India as well. Do you think that there is an audience in South Asia for the events that happen to the South Asian American community?
I wouldn't say some experience. I was an intern at the Hindu and for a little while at the Times of India, so basically bringing coffee cups to everyone. You know how it is. But yeah, India is a huge thing. My parents are in India, and you know, nothing captures their attention. They're like, yeah, what NPR? Now, public something. So my relatives either want to know, when are you going to be on television, or they're waiting for like one line in the Times of India, or, you know, back home. And even if it's on a website, it's like, "Ah, my daughter is something," you know, even if she wasn't a doctor. So I think that's really important, to get the message back home. And very often there are journalists back home. So, for example, we've got the Times. I think the Times of India is the most, if I'm not mistaken, the most read newspaper in the whole world. Can you imagine, and now online, that's without the, you know, the internet, can you imagine the audience you have? And there are journalists here reading the Times of India. So there's the correspondent for the Times of India is actually in DC. He's based here. Really, really nice person. You know, make those connections. If you get something, maybe, you know, in India, I very often read online, you know, Deccan Herald, blah, 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 to see, hey, what's going on over there? And then you never know now with the internet whether, you know, the story might be picked up here. So that, and, you know, if you've got relatives back home, that's a plus.
Definitely. I used to, before I wrote for India Abroad, I was a freelancer, and I was writing for Outlook and Economic Times and maybe others, I forget. And that stuff is read, you know, here as well. I mean, it's definitely nice when you go back to India and somebody actually can put a face to a name or whatever. But, you know, Chidananda Rajaratna is very influential. Other people in other publications as well, to varying extents. So, and also they're not pitched as hard as people who are based here. It's a different sort of a they all have certain relationships where they have very strong. You know, he might be like totally wired into DC, the Beltway network, or what have you. But there are other people as well, and they like it when you approach them, you know, because they suddenly have their, like, they have the column deadline in 2 nights, and they have no idea. And they're like, well, I was going to write about that party that I went to, that kind of thing. I met some Daisies, and it was a very New York Daisy thing, you know?
It was a very ephemeral thing, but they just have a deadline to meet. Suddenly you say, oh, my God, hey, you know, you should know this blah, blah, blah happened kind of thing.
And they suddenly feel like, oh, nobody else has covered that. That's kind of like, maybe I've got that story, you know? So, you know, you've got to consider that these kinds of, like, things that drive it. I mean, deadlines often drive it in the negative way, that you're like, I'm sorry, I've got so many other things. I'm not going to be able to do your important event I told you I was going to do. And they, you know, they can't come through like they said they were going to. But in many good ways, you know, it can you can figure out how they need you, you know.
Mohammed, do you differentiate your strategy for the various media outlets you're talking about?
In some sense, you know, in some cases, my director will come to me and say, you know, have this press release for India abroad, but don't bother with, you know, some of the other outlets. Or even in terms of what we can do with respect to access to survivors, because it takes a lot of time and energy on behalf of the direct services staff and the survivor, and, you know, whatever interpretation has to go on, confidentiality issues have to be negotiated. You know, if we're going to have access to an ethnic media outlet anyway, are we going to go through the trouble? You know, probably not. But if it's a major mainstream outlet that we want to try to contact, you know, that... yeah, then it's more likely, or we'll make more of an effort to do it. Yeah, it's just in some sense like a cold calculation of resources and priorities. So, you know, we do end up doing that.
So let's talk about Medium a little bit and how it's different to write a print story versus a radio story. As radio reporters, what in particular are you guys looking for when you think of stories that are pitched to you?
I don't know, maybe it's because I'm public radio. I don't really think, oh, there's a particular story that, you know, I would like versus, you know, a newspaper. I don't really compare us to television at all. It's more newspaper. I feel we compete with newspapers. Radio, though, is very intimate, so you definitely want the sound of people. You always want sounds in the background. So when someone pitches me a story or when I'm going out, I'm thinking, okay, what sort of sounds can I think of? So, for example, once I covered the guy who picks up roadkill, for sure I want sound of him on the highways, you know, screaming, you know, that sort of thing. So if you're pitching something about an Indian festival, for example, you know, what do you think of immediately? Food. You know, I want that sound of the cooking and blah, blah, blah. Okay, so things like that. But that's more on a reporter side. I mean, one thing I often get is I often hear people say, oh, I'm really scared of the media. I don't know how to give a sound bite. And I'm thinking, you don't have to. You know, that's my job, to get your story. Your job is just to tell your story. And if I don't understand, or if I think, I'm always thinking of my audience, if I think, oh, this is kind of boring, I'll just keep asking. I'll just keep asking till I get what I want, where I think, oh, people will really connect with that. So that's not your job. Your job is just to have the facts, to have a compelling story, and to tell it as honestly and openly as you can.
The thing with public radio is, yeah, is that it is very different from other broadcast media. They feel, in their other more commercial broadcast media, they will often go with, I guess, the more soundbite, right? And for us, I mean, they're like, it won't get past our editor. It'll be like, that sounds so canned, you know? And that's actually the mistake a lot of groups make, is they follow the lead of, you know, major groups which put out their press releases with these completely lame quotes, right? The quotes in these things are so boring. You don't even read the quotes. You like go to the figures, the quote is, the, you know, the mayor saying how great the mayor is and how great the city is and stuff like that. You're like, okay, whatever. And then you see the quote, the numbers and stuff like that. Now, they have the benefit of giving you the statistics and stuff like that. They can compile, which are really impressive and definitive and all that kind of stuff, which is harder for a small group. But a small group has the advantage of saying, like, listen, we're just a little guy. We're representing the little guy, that kind of stuff, you know. So don't take the model of the big heavyweight groups that put out these kinds of... And press releases generally tend, almost overwhelmingly tend to be really bad in terms of, they sound so clinical, you know, and their quotes are just useless, you know, and what you want is to get beyond that. I mean, the event, you know, I'd say even a big heavyweight event, major press, politicians and say their nonprofits that they're aligned with for whatever event. The event, if it's an hour long, will be completely unusable for the purposes of a public radio reporter because it'll all be very scripted. It's all at the end when you say, okay, well, now we have a question for you, and they have to pull out of their script, and then you say, well, tell me, you know, what is it really like, essentially, you know, or you pull them aside afterwards. And then in that, hopefully you get past the real obvious nervousness that one of those people says, and they say something that's just completely true, you know. It's just, you know, obviously it sounds true in the sense of it sounds true, you know. It's not just that it is factually correct or whatever. And that's the kind of a thing, you know, that actually sounds, it really appeals to somebody emotionally and intellectually, you know. So, basically, that's a trick. It's basically conveying that human interest dimension that has nothing to do with quotes, you know. And as for print, it's a different kind of print. Obviously, you can do a lot more nuance in certain ways. You have if you can do a 1,200, 1,500 word piece or whatever, you know, a lot of statistics. You know, we can't do a strong census story like the Times does a census story, which all these different numbers and stuff like that. But I might be able to do a census story on, a community and how it's changing, and maybe some numbers in there, but I can't drown you, you know, in facts and figures, you know. And, you know, we're looking towards census stories next year. We're looking at, oh, who are the nonprofits that can take us into that community and say, what is happening there? What are the demographic shifts to some extent, but also what's the story behind the story, what have you.
Okay, I definitely want to open it up for questions from all of you. Just one more question from Ahmed. I know that Saki is doing some of its own media. Can you talk a little bit about creating media within an organization instead of going for mainstream media?
Right, so one thing you can do if you don't have the resources or the time or you're not getting a lot of luck in terms of press visibility is to sort of create your own visibility. And I came on board with Saki in March of last year. We started a digital monthly newsletter. So, of course, it's not going to get the reach of, like, the New York Times. But the point was to really inform your own community and community supporters, donors, activists, volunteers, etc. Give them more information about what you do. You know, everyone who's connected with you knows what you do, broadly speaking, but you want to get a more human interest element. So, for instance, I started interviewing our policy intern to ask, you know, what she was actually doing in the process of putting together the survey instead of just having a bunch of numbers from the survey itself. Or I'd interview the economic empowerment intern instead of just presenting facts and figures about how many loans we gave out, how many women graduated from what programs. She could describe like the hands-on experience of working with these people and helping them navigate the issues of financial literacy or computer literacy or what have you. So it does give you an opportunity. And I'll say it's tough. I mean, it didn't sound like a big deal when I started out. A monthly newsletter, just once a month, you just interview some people. What's the problem? I was already a reporter beforehand. But depending on how big your organization is or what the issues are, again, we have the confidentiality issues. It can be tough. So you want to make sure it's focused. The one thing I'm glad we did get right is we were consistent. Like, we had 4 articles every month at the end of every month. And, there'd be a range of articles.
I just wanted to add 2 more things. When we talk about power, you know, between people who want to get their message out in the media, there were 2 things. Another thing that puts people in a position of strength is that reporters are always looking for news stories. They're always looking for news stories. And how do they get stories? You know, from people, they hear about it. So again, I mean, that just keep pitching, even if, you know, you don't get it on once, twice. Newsletters, call up reporters and say, hey, we've got a newsletter. I know you don't want to keep being bugged with press releases. Can I put you on our mailing list? You know, I'm on, oh my gosh, so many mailing lists looking for story ideas. Even if it isn't that exact story you'll have done, it's something else. But, you know, hopefully it'll make me think. Another thing is, the media hates, reporters hate getting things wrong. So, for example, with the beheading case, if I was, you know, with the organization, I wouldn't have just put out a press release. I would have called up the reporter, you know, and I would have called up the editor, and I would have said, hey, you know what? This is not true. You've got your facts wrong. When you deal with different communities, you know, you have to understand the nuances. We are specifically dedicated to this community. I mean, we really think that you should have contacted us, and this is my name and number, and next time, you know, I'd love to talk to you about anything. You know, hold their feet to the fire. Reporters and the media and stories you get are just a reflection of society. You know, and when you can get fired up, I mean, a lot of y'all are in not-for-profits, you know, really fighting the good fight. Why not do it with the media too? Mm-hmm. And in the same way, when you get stories that you're happy with, you know, make sure that you call up and say, hey, that was really, you know, really nice. It's very, very rare that people call in and say, oh, that was like a really good story. It's just assumed it's good. But the complaints, you know, that come in, you know, when there's something wrong. And I know for us, it goes all around the station. So any comment that comes in goes around the station. And I'm like, oh my God, I don't want any more mails. I hate her accent.
That's actually really empowering advice, I think, that you can pick up the phone, you can call the editors, and you can demand accuracy, because the media should report accurately.
Before I was a reporter, I was a student at the U of A in Illinois, and I remember once there was World Hunger Day or something, and the front page of the local newspaper had this guy, there was rice, and it was to make Americans here feel how difficult, you know, yeah, how difficult it is in developing countries where people only eat rice and they have to eat it with their fingers. And there's this, you know, bowl of rice and this guy like this, you know, this student trying to get there. I was so offended and outraged, and I wasn't in the media then, because now it's, you know, it's hard to call up a colleague and like, you know, but at that time as a student, and I had just come, it was 2 months, and I was like, this is outrageous. I called up the editor, I wasn't the reporter, then the editor, then the managing editor. I was like, I am Indian and I love eating with my fingers. You know, you don't understand, it's a cultural thing, it's not because I can't afford a fork and knife or whatever. You know, would you ever do this with, you know, a Chinese person? Would you say, oh, they can't afford this, so they're eating with chopsticks or something? I mean, outrageous, but I used to get really fired up, so you know, you need to too.
So let's hear some of your guys' questions, Uma. Oh, and introduce yourself and your organization so they know where you're from.
Hi, I'm Uma, and I'm with Chaya, which is a Lucky in Seattle, I guess, the anti-violence organization in Seattle in the Northwest. I have a really basic question, and both of you, Arun and Mohammed, both touched on the fact that we don't have, a lot of our nonprofit organizations and community-based organizations don't have a lot of resources and don't have a lot of time to do the press releases and to reach out to the media. And so, you know, we'll end up relying on our volunteers or community members who say, hey, I have this experience, and you have to rely then on the volunteer time to be able to do it and to do it quickly and all of that. Or there are trainings that say, hey, this is how you write a press release, and so somebody has to go to it and then bring it back to the organization, but then they still don't have the time to do it. So what I wonder is really basic, is there a template that actually we all can just steal and say, and that is relevant to our organizations, that we can actually cut and paste our story? Because we do write up our stories that we put out in our newsletters or in our, you know, mailing list or on our invitations or whatever it is for an event or for an article. Is there actually a template out there that we can literally cut and paste what we've already written that doesn't have to be, that we don't have to think too hard about formatting into a press release?
For what? For a press release? Huh?
Yeah. Or, yeah.
I'm sure, I don't know what it is. I'm sure it is, but I don't know.
I mean, so you're talking about really just control X from your newsletter and control V into the Word document?
Yeah.
You were geek, by the way.
Great community events.
So you can do a press advisory, who, what, when, where, why, you know,
yeah.
Just those five things with your contact information at the top. So you can find, you know, templates for press advisories and press releases, and just the formatting. And then, yeah, you could just fill in the actual text part, of course, and try to make that, you know, as compelling as possible. But yeah, the formatting, if someone on the staff doesn't know, is pretty easily available.
Yeah, I totally have done that for SALTs. You know, once we've already had an event and we're doing the event again the following year, I pull up last year's press release, I change it up a little bit, and we send it out. Because the reporters are looking for the basic information in there. You're right, you can make the text a little bit more compelling, you can update it. But the format is really basic. You can even Google what a media advisory press release looks like and just, you know, go from there. That's like the most bare bones PR that you can do. It can be pretty quick, I think.
Put your cell phone on there. That's the most important thing, I swear, because with small nonprofits, it's like you can never access them when you need them, like 8 p.m., and you're like, where is this person? And you find out a day and a half later because they finally go back to the office or whatever it is, and they check their, you know, that's a real common problem.
Yeah, you mentioned during our discussion about this panel that even after the story's done and the reporters interviewed you, you need to be able to access the person. You need to follow up with them as you're writing your story to make sure you have it right.
Right. Your editor asks you a question, or you realize that there's a hole or two, and it's after the event. It might be 2 or 3 days later or whatever, and that's when you need to still all the time be able to access that person, especially if it's like, oh my God, something has to, you know, run.
Go to organizations like, if you're, you know, advocacy for women, say, go to, you know, a large organization that you really admire who does it sort of in the mainstream, who can pay, like, tons of money to PR people to do it, and go to their webpage and go to news or press and look at how they do press releases and steal one of those. Just a spell check.
My name is Nina Baliga. I work with the National Coalition for Asian Pacific American Community Development National Capacity. First of all, I love your voice in the mornings. I get ready. So whoever those people are, they're strong. But you know, I was trained on kind of media training like 10 years ago, and you know, this panel's been really fascinating because you hear a lot of the same things I learned from 10 years ago, but there's actually quite a few differences too. And so I just wanted to know if you guys would comment on that. I mean, one of the things that I was trained on was it's all about building relationships with the media. If you want to get your story printed, you have to have strong relationships with them. But that was probably at a time when information wasn't as accessible by the internet, you know, when there wasn't always blogs with lots of specific information, so reporters kind of counted on their relationships to be able to flush out their stories more. So I just want to get a sense from you if I'm right in saying that that's true, and then two, like to what extent do you really look out to the blogs and other sources of information as they've grown in power versus the mainstream media kind of losing power in terms of, you know, being the sources of information for the public?
I wasn't working 10 years ago, so I don't know what it was like. I will say, though, it's much, yeah, that hierarchy is not there as much. If you don't have time to, I mean, it's not like reporters are sitting around like and have all the time to build relationships either, you know? I mean, it's like, oh my gosh, there are all these things to do. When people call, it's like really busy. But I think it's just the time you have making sure that, you know your stuff. More than anything else, better than a well-written press release, I mean, any of that stuff, have a compelling story. It always comes down to that. Why should people care about this story? What makes this a good story? And I think that's the main thing. But I don't know about the 10 years ago thing.
I wasn't a reporter 10 years ago.
Well, do you rely on cultivated relationships a lot, or are you just using the internet to find your stories these days?
That's true. I do think that definitely, you know, you can obviously find out a lot more about a person or an organization without having that, you know, that long-term sort of a relationship building by looking at. You know, for instance, if they have a blog, that makes it suddenly very accessible. You can see their history over, you know, hopefully the last blog post wasn't 9 months ago, which is sometimes the case, you know, or whatever it is. They have a visible presence or whatever. You can get a sense of where they're coming from, if they'll be helpful for you, that kind of stuff. The thing I mentioned a while ago, the whole reason I mentioned South Asian Philanthropy Project, which I forgot to add this part, which is that they had a blog, and they said, hey, we have this blog. It was like probably a few months into their doing it. And so that was intriguing to me because, A, it's an area I'd not known existed, which is, you know, this South Asian philanthropy, and looking at this from a couple people who were from, you know, who were lawyers. They were doing interesting things just, you know, online. They're bringing together different South Asian nonprofits. They're at Sudhir Venkatesh hosting this kind of a thing. All these different dynamics. And so, you know, I could really relate to this group. It was, of course, it was novel as well. And, you know, it's a big story, all this money, where is it, you know, going? There's statistics out there as well, you know, I mean, this is something that for my side job purposes, not for my, you know, day job or whatever. But that's the kind of stuff that really was very easy to sort of understand, you know. I mean, obviously everybody can't write a blog, you know, but if you do have a visible presence and you can kind of give a sense of who you are, what your group is all about, it makes it much easier if you have, you know, if you can do that online. And then we don't have to worry about, you know, going through some third party or whatever to find out in some way, you know, whether this person is credible or not.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Aleli Sampson. I'm with the National Asian Pacific American Bar Association. I was wondering if you folks could give examples of bad quotes and, as a follow-up, bad titles. To sort of the quicker documents like press releases, because we definitely feel we, as many organizations here, are doing important work that is newsworthy, but how do we make sure we get that across through quotes and headings?
So with radio, there's time is like, you know, anything I'm thinking in terms of seconds, you know, how many seconds is this going to be on air? So when your name is, say, Kavita Kadeza, Senior Vice President of the Division of Workforce Labor for the World Bank, God, 15 seconds in a one-minute story. So I'd probably just say Kavita Kadeza with the World Bank. You know, it's just too long. Short is always good. Even if you don't, you know, it's not executive director, even that. I'm just like,
Heads of World Bank, yeah.
Yeah. Something really quick. And your other question?
Just more examples. I really appreciate that helps.
Bad quotes.
Examples as to content as well. And that helps me override the folks that I do have to consult on press releases. When they say, he's also this, and she's also that, and they wear that hat, and that gives me...
Pick one. For the purposes of this story, what are you? What are you being quoted as an expert for?
Right.
You know, I mean, just think of it. You might be a mother, you might be a wife, you might be, you know, a daughter. When you say, oh, who are you, or what do? You don't give up. You pick one, you know. And the other one, the mayor of the city, every press release, and we have to do all we can to make this a world-class city. Never going to use it. Never.
Because it's just too vague.
Too cliché. What does that mean?
Right. It's so, I mean, almost all those quotes just are unusable for our purposes, especially for radio. And almost, I mean, you'll see that, and that's where you see the ethnic media will pick up those quotes, because they're like, you know, they don't have time. They're like writing four articles a day or something, you know. They're not going to use it, whatever you say in your press release, essentially. But when it comes to real quotes, you've got to think, does that sound like something somebody would say? I mean, in any conversation, you know? Like, is a mayor ever actually talking and chatting with his friends saying, you know, we're going to take the city forward and make it number one, you know, whatever. Like, you know, whatever. Or, you know, a non-profit. You know, it sounds like a real human being. I mean, it's a tough thing, obviously. You have to have some sort of, you know, aesthetic judgment or whatever. And that might not be your thing, but hopefully one of you can figure out, you know, how to make it ring true.
You mentioned some reading some quotes that are just boring and lame. Do you have examples of that? Besides being unuseful, it seems like that's another angle, right?
Right.
Some quotes are too vague, and, you know, it's all about making this city whatever, this some big accolade, right? But what about lame quotes about, like, issues that ought to speak for themselves, but maybe maybe it gets diluted somehow, right? Like,
why don't we work backwards? Why don't you tell us a story think would be, you know, you think the media should cover or whatever?
Sure. Voting, let's say voting rights. How do we talk? how do we have, you know, voting rights is one issue.
What about voting rights?
Right, so maybe I can name some issues and see if you guys have come across boring ones that that we're not inviting to you from your perspective. There's so many.
Like a language access issue kind of thing?
Sure, language access, voting rights, you know, immigration, comprehensive immigration, perhaps legalization. I mean, you get, it's very easy as lawyers to get caught up in the lingo we use, but
okay. So like, so if I mean, otherwise, I've always been like, you know, I've never been able to figure out how to really kind of capture the voting language access, voting rights issue kind of thing. Well, but if you introduce me to somebody who's like, you know, she's 78 years old, she grew up in communist China kind of thing, and you have to say, listen, I grew up in a place where I had no elections kind of thing, you know? I came here 7 years ago, and I became a citizen 4 years ago kind of thing. All I want to do is be able to vote kind of thing, you know? Because, okay. In China, I mean, you know, giving that, if you had a quote like that from her, it's like, you know, you give the backstory of this person kind of thing, rather than what I tend to see, which is pretty dull, I must say, the most of that. I mean, it's not been well packaged, the voting rights language access issue kind of a thing is not very easy to sell.
A lame quote over there would be, this is a very meaningful day in my life, and it is certainly a step forward for others like me.
Oh.
It's like, oh, I don't know, when I was in school in India, I grew up in India, the chief guest at sports, you know, sports day or graduation or whatever, oh, gee.
I mean, ideally, when you're sending out a press release, ideally, a reporter who's reading the press release is not just going to cut and paste. The press release is sort of a way to invite the reporter to follow up and call you and get a quote from you that's more real. I mean, if I, I'm just working for one of the weeklies in Queens, New York, if I ever just took a press release and copied and pasted a quote and put in a story, I'd be fired. I mean, that kind of stuff, you know, usually doesn't fly in the mainstream press. So, you know, think of it sort of as a sales pitch instead of just envisioning it as literally the text that's going to be in a story. Maybe that'll help.
You have to give people numbers and stories. That's true of press release, essentially. You have to give them facts and figures, and you have to give them, you know, the emotional side as well, kind of thing. And hopefully your quotes can do some of that. But yeah, just it should ring true, kind of thing. And it can draw directly from the people, you know, you're experiencing who are representing.
Let me grab all three of your questions and go through them together.
I'm Paige from the State Coalition, and my question is more around timing. We launch campaigns all the time or every so often, and I'm just wondering, in terms of notifying the press, like what is the like a good timing schedule? For instance, like when do we send press releases to the wire? When do we send press advisories to the press? Like, what? Like, because you were saying don't send it to me the morning of, but when? Because I hear that if it's too in advance, then you're gonna forget about it as well. So, what is a good timing schedule?
My name is Chase Chenoy. I'm a board member of API Domestic Violence Resource Project here in DC. My question is, how do you get on the expert list? How do you become, besides newsletters and all of that, how do you become that go-to person when it's a South Asian or API issue?
This is a little bit different, but I'm interested in how much you have control over the stories that you write and whether you are informed by the positions taken by the, you, like your parent company or whatever, the NPR or something. For instance, just as an example, we've been trying to pitch, I'm a journalist as well, but we've been trying to pitch a story about covering Sri Lanka, which is where I'm from, and where the mainstream media has been very one-sided in its coverage. And stories like, for instance, why is the U.S. not engaging or facilitating a multi-ethnic diaspora discussion here, which we've been trying to do, mm-hmm. but we can't even get access to the legislature. And or why is the U.S. pressuring Sri Lanka to give visas to foreign humanitarian aid workers? Why is it not focusing on the aid workers who are in Sri Lanka doing work and have been proven to have done work that is, you know, because they understand the cultural conditions in which they're working. For instance, we did a tsunami relief project there that in 1 year accomplished more than the Red Cross did in, with all its money, because they don't understand. But even pitching to, I mean, I was pitching to the World, for instance, that's a bit of a, you know, aiming high, but then I'd already been interviewed by the World before too. Mm-hmm. But I can't, you know, make that, I can't get through. So I'm just interested in how much you have control over stories.
So there's a question about timing for events and being on the expert list and then that issue of control.
Depending on how complex your story is, if it's a pretty simple, I'd say 2 weeks, certainly a week before, follow up. Mm-hmm. You know, I get people emailing, you know, reminder or whatever, or calling. That's absolutely fine. Okay. You know, don't just send it and think, oh, someone has got it. No, keep calling. Get the name of the person you speak to. Okay. Timing. Expert list. Just a quick email saying, hey, we have this organization, this is what we do, a paragraph, you know, if you ever need someone for da-da-da-da-da. And then if it's sent to me, I forward it to others, usually a mass email to the newsroom. Hey, you know, that sometimes personal relationships is tough to keep up because there's so much turnover, especially in television. I mean, it just seems like every day there's a new face on there, you know, and the same is true of other media. So sometimes it's good to, you know, just not focus so much on the personal relationship, but the organization. The other one, because it's, and I've pitched to the World and I've done stories for the World, a lot of times, like radio, I think they want sound, they want people on the ground. So I don't know, that is, because we're a member station, I think that would be sort of out of our scope. We might do something, a story, say, on Sri Lankans in the DC area who are trying to help, you know, their relatives back home. And if any of y'all have relatives back home, oh, wonderful. You can say, oh, I'm really worried. You know, this is what we're trying to do. This is the situation, that sort of stuff. But otherwise, you know, big things, questions like that, I don't think that a member state, at least, you know, AMU would do.
Is there a control that the parent company is exerting?
Oh, not at all, not at all. And 100% I have control over my pieces. Whenever I hear reporters say, oh, my editor made me do this, or my editor said, to me, if my voice is voicing it, then I will 100% stand behind that. And I will not voice something that I, you know, don't know is true or don't believe in.
Are you able to do stories that's, I mean, within, considering DC, because you're based here, that about access to elected officials, for instance, like Senator Casey is my senator from Philly, mm-hmm. and the inability to get him, and he's chair of the committee on Sri Lanka.
I would go to your member station in Philadelphia
and
say, hey, you know, especially when the whole thing is like going on, say, you know, we're a group of Sri Lankans and this is something that we really believe in, and we might be in this country but we have ties back home, so show that it has good news value because something like that is happening. And and I think that would be something a public radio station would, you know, would be interested in doing.
With Sri Lanka, it's a very tough, I think it's so underrepresented in terms of media coverage, and I think it's more difficult because it's one of the situations when it's so complex, and a lot of South Asians themselves, I mean, you know, don't want to go there kind of thing, because they feel like, you know, say you want to say, like, well, talk about government, you know, crackdowns and, you know, slaughters and stuff like that, oh, do you become the person who is an LTT, sympathizer kind of a thing, you know, that's a very tough kind of, like, you know, black and white sort of attitude that happens here in this country, of course, with media. And it's just an unfortunate, you know, part of the way then which it translates into media coverage, whether it's South Asian or mainstream kind of stuff. So I actually don't know how to get beyond that kind of thing. But, you know, definitely, you know, be persistent in the way that, you know, she was saying, you know, in terms of going there. In terms of the parent company kind of stuff, I don't think it really, I mean, even, you know, even media people think that that happens at other media outlets, you know, like, oh, you know, I'm sure that because it's them, it must be like that because, you know, Rupert Murdoch said it or, you know, that kind of thing, you know. I mean, everybody has these kinds of conspiracy theories, but, you know, I think it's for other more subjective kinds of reasons and stuff like that. As far as the go-to person kind of thing, you know, again, it can take a long time to become that person who suddenly, but then suddenly you might be the person who, when that big event flares up enough to get the attention of enough, you know, of people in the media in your city or what have you, then that all that stuff you've done for the last couple of years is suddenly, you know, and it might have been gentle or whatever, you know, you might have thought, God, this person never pays attention to me, but then it suddenly can become, you know. It helps if you've had, you know, those reports or, you know, those, you know, polls or whatever it is, which obviously are not necessarily that, you know, easy to do. You might not have the resources or whatever, you know, but when you know, consider alignments with, like, you know, academics and stuff like that, provided, of course, that you don't make the mistake academics make, which is they take any interesting story and they make it very academic and dull, you know. That happens all the time, and I have to tell people like that, you know, with my blog, that, you know, I'm like, you know, can you please make it sound like English, you know, make it a story, you know, and they'll make it, you know, very, like, whatever, post-structuralist or whatever, and, you know, and, with the press releases, yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, three or four times if you do that, and even if you say that morning, today, you know, in that subject line, you know, that kind of thing. I mean, I must say, you know, I think with Sikh Coalition and in other Sikh groups, I must say that I think that's the best example of really good and impressive sort of advocacy work in general. Is like, you know, Sikh community, what it's done in the last several years in terms of as a whole with the different groups and stuff like that. I feel like, again, I always, you know, read the press releases I get from Sikh Coalition or other groups, because it's always new information. It's always like, you feel like it's advancing the story. You know, every few weeks you see something new, and you remember what you saw a few weeks ago. Airport screenings. Oh, remember, and I'm like, oh yeah, I heard what I remember last, you know, a few weeks ago. You know, now I see this, and it always keeps me interested. I won't always be writing or covering it, but then when I'm doing it one day, I feel like I'm doing it with some sense of knowledge and history that they brought to me, you know. So I think that you can really study what the Sikh community has done, you know. Maybe might be differences of quality within it, I don't really know, but I think generally speaking, it's very impressive what's happened after 9/11, you know. Yeah.
Okay, we just have a few more minutes, so I think we'll leave it there with questions, just because I want to give the panelists a chance just to, you know, craft the last word, and then you can come down and catch them before they go. In every session that we're doing in the summit, we're trying to leave it off with some sort of a call to action. And I know it's a little different in this session because these are reporters and not necessarily people that are part of the nonprofit industry, but what would be your sort of next step or call to action to the folks here in terms of getting their message out to the media? And if you could all just address that here. Okay, so you want to start down there, Mohammed, maybe?
I would aim for being concise. Try to avoid wordiness, try to avoid jargon, make your whatever you're writing or presenting accessible. Just imagine that whoever you're presenting it to has never heard of this issue or topic before. It's pretty simple advice, but it's very easily and very often forgotten.
Now, be a positive personality, even when you're representing really negative stuff, because people get turned off by, you know, by that, and they won't even necessarily recognize that. But they want to deal with people who they, you know, and even if you're telling them terrible things, which is often the case, you know, and you know that they might not be able to do it this time, you know, be sympathetic in that sense, you know, because they more likely than not will not be able to do it this time in terms of covering that kind of stuff. And, you know, just think long-term again. You think, be very patient, much more patient than you think, because it might take years for that, you know, that thing to pay off. You know?
I think mine would be, and this is just me as a person, not as a reporter talking, believe that you have a right to be covered, that your stories are important and your community is important and you have a story to tell. And if there are other groups being told, well, why not ours, you know? So I think that should be the attitude, not, please, 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 can you cover this? Like, hey, this is a good story, cover it. Yeah.
Write letters to the editor. Mm-hmm. I think it makes a difference. You know, you see that person there, like, oh, you know, it's interesting. I mean, we all, don't you always notice that facey name in the letters there, you know? I mean, you know, 10 years ago, it was like a big deal, you know? It was like much more interesting than seeing you win the spelling bee. You know, now we obviously, you know, our threshold is so much higher. But it's interesting. You know, you see that expert, you know, and don't be afraid of capitalizing on some of those obvious sort of, you know, slumdog events, you know, that kind of thing, in a way which is obviously tasteful, you know, use it appropriately, that kind of thing, you know. But think, you know, this is an event that's happening, it might be on the other side of the world. It might have nothing to do with what your particular agenda is as a group. But you as an expert coming out of the group kind of thing, you might be the only person who's going to actually approach that editor and say, listen, this is something you might not know. I'm the person who should tell this kind of thing. I can tell it to you by tomorrow, that kind of thing, you know. And, you know, think of those opportunities. It takes a lot of, you know, it takes a lot of time to build up that particular, that talent, you know. But you don't have to have, I mean, it always helps, of course, if you have a book to back it up. You know, I'm an author of such and such. But, you know, all of us don't have that. But do think in terms of saying, I've got this expertise and I can tell you something that nobody else knows right now, your readership or whatever. And that'll reverberate throughout other media people. People notice those things, you know.
Great. That's a great place to leave it off. Thank you so much, you guys. And it's